three ball from CG43. They're in front.
This is flat out ridiculous.
From the beautiful left hand, in and out finish, the old fashioned way.
Newell gets to the basket with one to come. From there again. You have got to be kidding me. Tyson Steph.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Joseph Corr is my name from Stats Perform Media. My guest today is Chris Anstey. I don't think he needs any introduction. Melbourne Tigers, Southeast Melbourne Magic, and the Australian Boomers. You all know who he is. But above all those other things, he's author of a new book called Tall Tales. And it's out and available. Go to chrisanstey.com.au to buy the book. I'll put a link in the description so you can go and do it. That's not through Booktopia. I don't get a cent from that. That's just purely for Chris, and by all accounts, it's a good read. I haven't read it yet. I haven't been able to secure a copy. I'm reading some other stuff at the minute, but I would if I could. Be great. What do we discuss in this one? Chris Anstey and I broach a number of subjects, obviously stemming from, you know, we have a mutual acquaintance in Paul Shirley. We speak about him and his book and you know, Chris Anstey's time in Russia when he snubbed the coach and they went out drinking and Russian hookers and things. Dined with and little and nothing else with Russian prostitutes. And it's in Paul's book, Can I Keep My Jersey? Then we also talk about the Boomers, Ben Simmons. You know, I think there's a current trend now where the Australian basketball public seem to want to hit snooze or skip on the Ben Simmons Boomer era and just skip straight through to when Josh Giddey is of age to take over. And that, I get that impression from fans. I get that impression from some of the people in and around the Boomers camp itself. I pose that question to Chris Anstey. We also talk about Sydney 2000. A lot is made about the Boomers culture and win first, all for one, one for all, three musketeers. And yet in 2000, when if winning's a premium in the Boomers culture, I think myself and a lot of people would hold the opinion that Ricky Grace should have got more time on the floor and the Boomers looked better when he was on the floor. Did personal relationships get in the way of winning, even at the most sacred and sanctified Australian Boomers level? We talk about that. And Chris, as always, is very open and honest and speaks well. So I really hope you enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Anstey.
All right, let's start out with this. Chris Anstey, I'm going to start out with a compliment, okay? The two-way talk podcast you did, I thought that was really good. I really feel like you and Wurtho and Stremple and I want to say, who was it?
Candy.
Candy. You guys, that was the first podcast where you guys spoke seriously about women's basketball. It was, you know, you guys said positive things. You guys said negative things. You gave critiques. You said when things were good, when they were bad, and why. You really treated women's sport with a real dignity and courage and respect that I think was one of the first times I've seen that. So hats off, first of all.
No, thanks. And that's exactly what we tried to do. And I've been coaching women's basketball now for 5 years. My daughter plays, and you realize how under-resourced they are. But as they battle to get seen and as their product improves, we need to make sure that we don't talk about our female athletes as mums or talk about what they do away from the sport. We do need to treat them as athletes because they are. They're professional athletes, and we need to analyze, discuss them accordingly in the exact same way we discuss our male athletes. So that's what we wanted to do. We were rapt that every single game was on television, and that almost became the reason we did it, because there was nowhere to hide for these girls anymore. And sometimes in my experience with women's basketball is that you can have three or four bad games and no one really knows because they don't see it, but you can have one and put it on social media and people think you're great. So there was a real sense of responsibility we felt for the WNBL players to make sure that, because every game was on television, to make sure that they gave the viewer reason to watch. And we wanted to make sure we discussed and analyzed them through that lens, but we really enjoyed it. We didn't want to continue it into the NBL space. There's enough of that. The NBL's got its own thing, and hopefully we can find a way to do it when the next WNBL season rolls around again.
Did you get any feedback? Like, did any of the women's players say, like, I heard what you said, F you?
No, not really. I don't think it ever reached enough people where it became mainstream, but we certainly had really great feedback from the people who listened. We didn't want it to be a magazine-style type podcast where we brought the players on to interview them. We wanted to discuss them, and we didn't want it to drag on into being 45 minutes or an hour long. So we didn't get much, and yeah, we went pretty hard at a few, but we feel that we were fair if we were hard on someone, and we'd be absolutely supportive of them in a different game. And yeah, that's what we get again with the men's game. And the great thing was, and again, this was during lockdown, so it was actually fun to sit down and watch women's basketball every single night.
Yeah, I remember.
Through an analytical lens, I suppose, and it was great for my daughter to be able to watch it, and was great for other young female basketball players who play junior basketball to know that although they're locked down, they can turn on the TV any night and watch a league that they aspire to be in without having to watch the men's game.
Yeah, I got you. Let's change tact here. Lastly on that, I'd encourage you and Werther to do something again. The pairing of you two is really good. But going on from that, Paul Shirley. Paul Shirley's done this podcast a couple of times. Just recently, about maybe a week or two ago, we spoke about his new book, Ball Boy. When I chatted with him about you, this is what he said. He said of you, he's one of the few people I ever played with who thought exactly like I did, which was, if you're open, shoot it. If not, pass it. And let's try to win the game. He knew how basketball worked at a granular level. He understood the global nature of the game. I think this has something to do with his playing tennis. We met at the right time. He had, like I had at that time, become a little jaded. But remember now, cynicism comes from initial optimism. Do you agree with all those assessments of yourself?
No, it's a nice compliment. No, like Paul, my second year in Russia, and you know, Paul had come across on a contract to replace me when I had my appendix out, and did so well that the team wanted to keep him. And you know, Ira Clark was also there. So we ended up with three imports for a few months while Paul stayed. And no, we connected, and neither of us saw ourselves as purely basketball players. We saw ourselves as human beings who were pretty good at basketball. And as you said, we sometimes overcomplicate a pretty simple game. As often as we coach and as often as we play, we're yet to see someone run faster or dribble a ball faster than passing it. So, yeah, it did. It became simple, and we had a really good connection on and off court. And I would have loved for him to stay longer and finish off the season, but, you know, he had a contract to get to with the Phoenix Suns. But, yeah, you're right. We're a little bit jaded and a little bit realistic. And
jaded at the same. The game, jaded from the business of basketball?
No, it was probably a combination of a little bit the game and the way that it was two-hour sessions every day, and it was pretty monotonous, the type of training sessions that you would have in Eastern Europe, but also the climate, the lack of people in Russia that spoke English, right. The lack of being able to get outside because of this, you know, the sub-zero temperatures. It was a battle, but you know, at the same time, we knew how well we're getting paid. We're setting our families up. Yeah. And we knew there was light at the end of the tunnel, and we knew that it was an experience, and we had to find a way to make it fun. So, yeah, we had a good time. He probably drinks a little bit more after meeting me than what he did before he met me, because we went out a little bit while we were in Russia.
But we
stayed in touch. And, you know, you mentioned Paul's book, Ball Boy. He's written a few books, and I love his, you know, Can I Keep My Jersey book, which was outstanding and really shows how he sees the game of basketball. But back then when we were together, there was no social media. And so I was in the habit, as he was, of writing these long-winded group emails back to family and friends and hoping some people replied. And I asked him to send me one of his one day, and he sent it to me. And you might as well have wiped your ass with what I was writing. It was horrible. And so I started sending his back to my family. And then, how about this? This is what I've been trying to say for 2 months. And Paul did it so well. But he's just, tell you what, he's talented as a writer. I love his stuff. And, you know, as you might have mentioned, I just finished my first book. And Paul was the guy I reached out to. the guy Paul used for cover design and, you know, and all that different typesetting type, all the different back-end stuff was Paul. Yeah. And he was a massive part of me being able to actually finish and get my book completed.
If I'm not mistaken, when you, Al Westover, or maybe you, there was talk of Paul coming to the Melbourne Tigers. Do you remember, like, pushing him to be recruited or signed? Do you remember that time?
Absolutely.
Did that get quite heated? Did that get close?
Yeah, we were close. And the thing wasn't, you know, Martin Mercep ended up coming, and you think about those two guys, they're both big, they're both athletic, they've both got international experience. But the other thing was, back then the NBL didn't have the salary cap it does now, so there was a premium on guys who would come and play because they'd already made their money and they wanted a summer. Yeah. Or they wanted to live in an environment that wasn't Russia. And, you know, Martin came, Paul Neely came. And, you know, a lot of people, when you go to the States, say, I'd love to get to Australia. I'll get there one day with no intention of ever doing it. Paul's been. He's stayed at my house. He's been and seen it. He's been to Illawarra Hawks games. He's been to Melbourne Tigers games. He's done it. It got really, really close.
Yeah. Your book, Tall Tales. I haven't read it yet. I'm going to get a copy, and I will. You tell a lot of stories in the book. Don't tell any stories in the book. This is my question for you. Was there a story you wanted to put in the book that didn't make it because of maybe length, or perhaps someone dissuaded you from putting it in? And if so, do you wish to sort of share what that is?
No, not really. And, you know, it's amazing when you have conversations with people, what you remember and then how important it becomes as you start figuring out what it meant to you. And there's a story I'll write if I do another book about the most points I ever had in a game in the NBA was 26. Mm. And I had it against the Boston Celtics. My mum and dad were there. It was on my mum's birthday. And we won the game. I was so happy, excited, probably consumed in my own night of success. And, you know, went out for dinner and was celebrating. It was one of the rare games we didn't have to get on a plane and go. And towards the end of the night, a bottle of champagne came across, and the waitress said, look, this is from the guy who was just leaving. And I looked across, and it was Eric Riley sort of doing this one on the way out the door. And so Eric was my teammate at the Dallas Mavericks and hadn't played a minute that game, and was essentially a guy that I was battling for a contract and for minutes. And he said, I'm really happy for you. Congratulations. Oh. And looking back, you just think, and it meant a lot on the night, but even more so as I've got older and maybe a little bit more balanced, that's who I've always wanted to be as a teammate, someone that enjoys it or takes enjoyment in my teammate's success and in other people's success, not just my own, because as athletes we get really self-centered. But he was at a stage in his career where he was happy for me on a night where he could have been disappointed for him. Yeah. And I've always remembered it, and I've probably become more and more appreciative of it over the years as I've got older. So that's one that I'll write about at some stage and go into a lot more detail than that about the game and the night. But, yeah, I reckon that.
That one. All right. I want to change tact here. Like, you've been to the NBA. You've seen – I've heard you on the Bread and Body podcast talk about, you know, the Leon Rose and the 250K and, you know, the sort of the what it could be classed as maybe the sleazy side of pro sports, big money, move and shake. From an Australian perspective, like, the United States has that little bit of a sleazy element, or at least that perception. Is it the same here in Australia? Did you think it was better business here, or more noble business? You know what I mean?
I guess what I always measured it on was what the locker room was like, because I think the really great teams have a tendency to be able to become a little bit insular from the club and the sport as a whole. You become really involved in your own group. And, you know, I left the Southeast Melbourne Magic and Brian Gorgian was the coach. And for me, that was as good a sports culture as I'd ever been a part of, the way we pushed each other, the way we believed in each other, the way we supported each other, all the different types of things that we now know to be cliches. Yeah. But I stepped from that into something that was a lot more individual. You know, everyone was out for themselves to some level. I was a fish out of water in America, and I didn't have that person to just grab me and say, it's going to be okay. So it was hard. I never really experienced that in Australia, but, you know, the more money that's involved, the more people want it, and it tends to get that. But, Yeah, you mentioned sleazy in the NBA. I mean, I think they've come a long way as well. And you look at what Greg Popovich has done for the Spurs, and you look at guys like Steve Nash, who I played with, and there are some great teams in the NBA now. And that's a really hard thing to do with the ego and the money. I mean, you hand a 20-year-old kid $30 million and ask him to be humble. It's a tricky thing to do, but I think we're getting better at it.
I mean, I think maybe it's getting worse. Like, I look at Clutch Sports and I'm like, wow, like, you see Chauncey Billups get hired. He had 2 years head coaching experience. Even Steve Nash, like, hasn't served the longest coaching apprenticeship to get to that spot. And I worry about the machinations behind the scenes, but, you know, who's to know?
Yeah, it's funny with Steve, and Steve was an interesting one because I heard the race conversation, I heard the inexperience conversation. But sometimes it comes down to who you are as a human being, because you need to have the respect of the group. They need to know you care for them. They need to know that you're, of course, educated enough and capable enough to get them to where they need to go. And I still think the best leaders I've ever been around have the ability and the humility to surround themselves with people who are great at the things that they're not great at. And it's never just the head coach, it's a group. So I don't know enough about Chauncey Billups, but when I heard about Steve, it made sense. And I know about his relationship with Kevin Durant. And, he was dealt – I mean, there probably wouldn't have been many head coaches. And, you know, he's probably the polar opposite to David Blatt, if you remember him, who was coach at Cleveland when LeBron was there and got forced out of town. He was that disciplinarian, came from Europe, an extraordinarily qualified and highly respected coach, but couldn't quite communicate to those ego guys at their level and didn't quite understand them. And, you know, Steve understands them. He's been in their locker room. And look, every situation is different. I think you can always find a case for and a case against anyone.
Yeah. I enjoyed your chapter in Matt Logue's book, Hoop Dreams Down Under. I think you, Bradke, Gaze to a lesser extent, you guys in that book, I got the impression a little bit jaded after that NBA experience. Bradke especially, his chapter was quite downtrodden. With so many Australians flourishing now in the NBA, what's changed? And I think what I'm getting at here is, I think I heard someone, a young player, talk about how when an NBA player is drafted now, they go to like a 2-week camp in Las Vegas. They get showed about, here's your money, here's where it goes, here's how to behave on social media, here's what's going on. They get kind of taken through. When you were drafted, was it just like plonk, Dallas, you sit next to Ross Perot? I think that was a guy. Are you just Ben or what?
No, look, I was always fortunate to have Leon Rose. So he always made sure I was okay. And
I meant the owner of the Dallas at that point was who? Ross Perot?
Yeah, Ross Perot, of course. But Leon is my agent.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Made sure that I was okay. And so the things he described.
Ross Perot, like, didn't he go around the world?
I only ever met him really briefly. But, you know, I think what's changed, I think the world shrunk. I think the impression of international athletes from an American perspective has improved. I think the wider NBA community just thought all international players were soft. We weren't as good as what they were. And they were almost against us before they were with us. Even Dirk, when he started, the Dallas Mavericks weren't big fans of Dirk Nowitzki at the start. He had to really earn that. But I think now with Luka Doncic and, you know, Giannis coming in, these type of players, there's a greater level of respect for international basketball when these players enter the NBA. We have more access to watching the EuroLeague, the NBL, and scouts fly around the world and have a greater understanding of who they're drafting and who they're recruiting, more so than what they did back then. So, yeah, look, it's great to see so many there. And I think social media helps with that. Again, it just shrinks the world. And, you know, as an international player so far away from home, and even my daughter's in college in America, she's just left, we can pick up the phone, we can have video calls like we're doing now at any time. I can get on a plane and be with her tomorrow.
Right.
So I think that's a really big part of it. But, you know, guys like Andrew Bogut, you know, when you ask what's changed, Luke Longley made it possible to be successful. Andrew Bogut almost went and took that to another level from an individual perspective. And I think, you know, then we saw Patty Mills, Matthew Dellavedova, and we keep going, that we know we can do it now. And there are so many Aussies in college, I think, that are highly respected. So long-winded answer, but, you know, we've evolved.
Yeah. Speaking about evolving, like, you watch The Last Dance, right? And you look at Jordan in that, and you could say, like, oh, geez, real competitive.
You could also say workplace torment. And, you know, you've met Longley, you know Longley. And I would have thought Longley, I mean, sometimes I get the impression from Longley, he's quite sad about his experience, that it was really mentally, really physically, mentally, you know, tough and depressing. You know, not interviewed for that interview and for that show. And did he ever say to you, like, shit, this was nowadays, this would be considered workplace harassment type stuff? Or is that?
Luke sees the sporting world through a lens broader than most of us. And I never got the sense, even in speaking and speaking with him and hearing him speak publicly, which I've been fortunate to do because not many have. Mm. He knew where he sat, he knew his role. Luke, you know, I wrote a chapter about Luke in my book, and he's one of the most generous people that I've come across in situations where there was no need to be generous. And he reached out to me when I got there and put me under his arm, even while he was going through that year of The Last Dance, and that was a circus. But
yeah,
if you hear Luke speak now, what he learnt is incredible. And, you know, to describe it, it's funny, someone asked him once publicly, you know, what sort of traits do the best athletes in the world have? And I think he said they're selfish pricks, because you kind of have to be better than everyone in the entire world at one particular thing. You've got to be so self-centered and single-minded that you're not great at many other things. And I think that might have been a bit of a theme, more so than it was sadness, but having the ability to observe that and not let it affect you, I think speaks to the level of who Luke is as a human being.
I want to go to something a bit lighter. In one of the chapters of Paul's book, Can I Get My Jersey, he talks about a night where you left your hotel and snubbed the Russian coach. The Russian coach was like, no one leaves the hotel. And you just not only walked out of the hotel, but walked right by him, gave him the light, thanks, going out for a good night.
Yeah.
And then you go out, you get into a really long taxi ride, you bump into Russian hookers. Tell me about that night or what you remember of it. But more importantly,
you know, the funny thing,
the
funny thing was, I thought Paul had picked up. I didn't. And I went, no, look, it was just that. I mean, it was such a, you mentioned before, were you jaded by Russia, that when we took the opportunity to go out and explore when we could, we'd go and sit in bars, we'd go to restaurants. We weren't prepared to sit in dingy hotel rooms in the middle of Siberia.
And not people don't know, it's bleak over there. I've been to St. Petersburg, and that's like St. Petersburg is the height of it. And the other,
We wanted to go and sit by an open fireplace or see what a Russian bar looked like and see some of the old architecture. So, yeah, we walked past, okay, so cut us. I mean, we knew they weren't going to cut us. We were playing well. We knew we'd just won that night. You know, we didn't fly out that night. We flew out the next day and didn't play for 4 days. So, I guess it's not ideal, and if I'm coaching, I certainly wouldn't want my players disobeying. But at the same time, I'd never tell my players don't go out and have a life, because I would understand more that they need to do that. So we had some fun nights, and we met some interesting people. It was a wild ride.
Let's change tape again. Ben Simmons, man, this stuff has just come up. This is interesting. This is a really almost a linchpin moment in Australian basketball, this whole Ben Simmons thing, how it's going to play out. I'm going to challenge you with this one, but let's go with it. I'm a bit nervous to ask this question, but
there we go.
Boomers culture, is it all it's made out to be? Call me cynical, but the way I look at it is the Olympics is no longer amateur. It's not like it was when Lindsay Gaze played and it was, you know, hardware workers who dropped tools and went away for 2 weeks and then came back and, you know, it's professional players who are paid to play. I would think even at the Olympic level, and within that team, because within every team, we just talked about it, you got to be killer instinct, you got to be selfish, you got to be jealous, there's ego. How are the boomers exempt from that? And if I'm wrong, so how and why?
Yeah, no, look, the brotherhood's real, as in when you get there and when you're together, it's real. Now, there are still certain expectations, I think, when you're talking about people making $10 million a year and accustomed to a certain way of being treated or traveling, that they expect a little bit more. That's no different, but the camaraderie within that group is real. And I suppose that's the disappointing part about Ben not making himself available to be a part of it, because personally, I would have loved to have seen how he would have thrived in that environment with a group that, you know, wrapped their arms around him and supported him and appreciated what he could do, not what he couldn't do. and maybe be that circuit breaker that he needs for his NBA career. Unfortunately, we don't get that. And I really feel for Patty Mills, Joe Ingles, Aaron Baines, Chris Golding, these guys who've represented the country at an Olympic Games before, Matthew Dellavedova, and come so close and have done in the past anything to put the singlet on and have done what they can now to be a part of it, to have someone who could have potentially made this massive positive difference say, no, I'm going to go and work on my jump shot. So I'm disappointed for those guys, but I also know that the minute Ben made his choice, they would have gone straight to worrying about what they have in the locker room, not what they don't have. So, yeah, it's real. Yeah, there are egos, but there need to be egos, I think, to compete, because there needs to be a level of self-confidence and confidence within your group to say we're going to take a swing at Team USA or we're going to take a swing at Serbia and know that it's real. It's not just talk.
I think the other thing I want to say is, like, you talked about the brotherhood's real. I want to talk about the commitment to winning, and this is something that's been gnawing at me for 20 years. And I was only young when I watched the 2000 Olympics, which you were part of, and that Boomers team. And if the Boomers have a sort of win at all costs, or, you know, three musketeers, all for one, one for all motto, Sydney 2000, Ricky Grace. I think myself and a lot of people feel like he should have played more. He is the best point guard who's played in this country. Maybe D-Mac, hard to say. Was there ever that conversation at that 2000 Boomers team about that conversation that maybe in the interest of winning that, you know, Ricky Grace should have got more time?
Not one that I was involved in, certainly. But, you know, we didn't start that tournament well. And, you know, again, I wrote a story in the book about it, because it can go from being one of the highlights of your life to one of the lowlights in your life really, really quickly in an event. And that's what the Sydney Olympics were for a lot of us. And, you know, we didn't start the tournament great. And there was a sense that, you know, Ricky had played a couple of really great games. I'd found a few extra minutes. Jason Smith had come in and done really well. And a few of us bench guys really felt like we were playing our way into the tournament. I agree with you. Ricky Grace was exceptional and provided something different, not better or worse, different to what Shane Heal was. And we battled back to be in that last four, and Ricky was a big part of that. And, you know, it felt like at the time we went back to what we'd been in the earlier rounds and not what we'd been in the previous rounds, where it's a common thing for coaches to go back to what they trust in the games that mean the most. And that's what that game was. But, you know, the rotation shortened, and, you know, it was disappointing that we got blown out. You know, it was interesting. And again, you allow yourself some level of individual disappointment as well as the team disappointment, and one of the ones I remember being disappointed at, and, you know, there's a kid named Gregor Fuschka who played for Italy, and he was 7 foot tall. He was skinny. He was prim, and I'm thinking, this, I'm playing well. This is a great matchup for me, and I never got a look at him. You know, I came in garbage time in the last few minutes, and by then, I was young. I was pissed off. I kicked the sign, and I got into trouble from Barry Barnes, and, you know, I was mad enough to say, mate, if me kicking a sign, the thing that you're going to take out of this loss, God, that loss killed me. If kicking the sign kills you and not the loss, then we're on completely different planets right here. But, yeah, again, it's not probably the way I'd go about it now, but I was gutted. And we did the same, you know, in that bronze medal game. We didn't play our best basketball. So, yeah, no, Ricky, I respect as much as any point guard in this league that I haven't played with, and I played with D-Mac. You know, so selfishly, I put D-Mac right on the top of the list, but I always knew that to beat Perth, and it wasn't just Ricky, it was Andrew Vlahov, who was a part of that group as well, and it was Scott Fisher, and it was James Crawford, but yeah, you knew it was Ricky. Yeah, it was the Sydney Olympics was a really, really tough pill to swallow for a long time, with not being able to perform how we needed to perform to win a medal for whatever reason.
I always felt, I mean, Shane Heal and Barry Barnes have a very close relationship. I always felt maybe that colored things a certain color, but that's just me. Speaking of D-Mac, did you ever see his episode of Judge Jury? Judge Judy, pardon me?
And he said that, he goes, when I was trying to get custody, I flew back and I knew I had to court. Judge Judy. I'm like, really? But, I did see the episode. And,
oh, wow. I thought that was fake Wikipedia thing. That's real. Wow.
Yeah, no, I saw it and he's talked about it. And, how great DMACC is, raising six kids by himself, with help here in Melbourne. But he's an incredible human being, DMACC.
I want to go to something else. Going back to sort of boomers, Ben Simmons. I don't know if you get this feeling. I certainly do. I'm getting a feeling that most basketball fans kind of want to see the end of the boomer Ben Simmons era before it's even really started. And they seem to want to skip straight to the Josh Giddey era. And I even get that vibe from Andrew Bogut in comments he's made. Do you get that vibe? I know you're quite close with Giddey and that, but do you feel that like I do?
I get the vibe that, with Ben, if not now, when? When's the right time to play for the country? And maybe I'm a little bit skeptical, but I don't see him ever playing for the country. He's had his opportunities to do it. And, I think he'll regret it. But, maybe he'll change his tune a little bit. And we all make different choices with years of experience under our belt. But, the other thing with Ben, if he had have availed himself for the Tokyo Olympics, I think he would have really won back a lot of support from the Australian basketball public. Mm-hmm. I think we would have jumped on his back and supported him like crazy and put our backs up if people had a go at him. But that's not to be. And I think for the people who are on the fence, I think we'll see it go the other way where we really, really want to support Ben. It's almost like we've always wanted to support Nick Kyrgios, but we couldn't. And the minute we get a glimpse, we do. I think, Ben, we want to support him as a basketball public, but he hasn't given us as a nation reason to outside of the NBA. Yeah, we respect him and admire him, but we want to love him. And I think we're going to love him most if and when he ever puts on a boomer singlet, but it's looking less likely maybe that he ever will, because as you say, let's not put too much pressure on Josh Giddey, but he's the next era like Patty Mills was. And I don't see Ingles, Daly and Patty Mills all being at the next one. It's going to be a very, very different boomer squad at the next Olympic Games. Like when Gaze Hill, Bradkey Longley handed over, there's going to be another handover and, the next Olympics is going to be it.
Mm. Let's jump onto something else. NBL stuff. You've talked about this before, but I really want to hone in on this. Like, all the teams you played for are gone from the NBL, right? All of them? Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you apportion any, who do you apportion, if you apportion any, blame to for that? Like, do you sort of go, oh man, the club could have done better and still been around, or the league should have supported the club? Or do you feel any animosity towards that lack of a home now? You know what I mean?
I don't feel animosity. I feel sadness. I would love to have a Melbourne home and I don't. And there are a lot of us, North Melbourne Giants, Southeast Melbourne Magic, Victoria Titans, Victoria Giants, Melbourne Tigers, and then go back further to Coburg, Spectres, Geelong. We don't have
a lot of teams.
I would love, I'd love for there one day to be maybe a training facility, an elite training facility with everyone's banners and everyone's singlets and an event space or whatever it might be where we could call it home. I don't blame anyone. I guess the only maybe sliding doors moments I was close to was when the Melbourne Tigers rebranded themselves as Melbourne United and I was the head coach. And I got told about it that morning. I had to come into a press conference, blindsided, and I had to talk about it. And I'm a Western Bulldogs AFL fan. And I've seen Hawthorne, I've seen the Bulldogs be on their knees, go to the members, go to the corporates, almost begging for support. Look, if we can't do this, we're going to have to fold or merge. And both teams found a way to survive. I would have loved for the Melbourne Tigers fans and supporters to have been given the chance to save the club before it was rebranded. Because I understand the numbers, but I don't think even the fans knew how dire it was. But if you don't know, you can't help. So I would have loved to have seen a period of time where we fundraised, begged for memberships, begged for sponsorships, and try to keep the Melbourne Tigers alive because it's an iconic brand.
Yeah.
But, sadly, I don't see that coming back because that's still owned by the Melbourne United group or Larry or whoever it might be. But Yeah, they still hang the singlets up in the rafters, but there's no connection with the Melbourne Tigers. There's no connection with any of the other clubs from a player's perspective.
I mean, I want to talk about that with you. NBL financials, right? You've been a part of the NBL as a player and not just a training player when you were at Southeast Melbourne Tigers initially and then Southeast Melbourne. But then you were a player in a small sense. Then you came back and you were a star and then you're a coach. Like, you've seen the financials of the NBL from a lot of perspectives. Why do you suppose there just hasn't been that real upkick of sustainability, if not profit? What do you suppose?
Sometimes you need, and one thing, the top thing Larry's been great at is he put his money where his mouth is, and he's worth a lot of money. And you look at the European football model, their owners are worth a lot of money. And sometimes you are dependent on the generosity of one Eddie Groves of Brisbane. But the threat is if they decide they no longer want to do it or they can't, it's just gone. So you're right, the greatest challenge right now is sustainability and allowing it to be profitable. And it's on television, the corporate attendance is good, membership's up, and attendance is up across the board. And we often compare it to the 90s where we get 15,000 people at Rod Laver, but I always like to remind people that we'd play the Canberra Cannons in that same season and get 2,500, or play Newcastle and get 3,000. So it wasn't an every game thing. It's a little bit of rose-coloured glasses, whereas now there are more people in more stadiums more often, and there are definitely more people watching it on TV. So, teams aren't losing as much money as what they were, to the best of my knowledge, but that's the challenge, to provide a sustainable business model that encompasses more than just basketball, that incorporates stadiums and perhaps hospitality and events. But there are smarter people than me to make those choices, and certainly richer people than me to buy the teams to do it.
Talked about making a model that's sustainable. I want to take you back to when you lose to the South Dragons and they fall, and the league is right. I mean, that was a shaky year where the league is on its knees. And as I understand it, they have that year. The next year, only 8 teams return. And as I understand it, the Melbourne Tigers were the last team to kind of say, instead of going with like a total shutdown, tear it down, new model, the Tigers kind of go, all right, we'll roll it back in. And somewhat begrudgingly is what I've sort of been heard or told. I mean, you were there, you were part of that sort of decision. Do you feel like maybe shutting it down and a return to like fully amateur wages come down, do you think that would have created a sustainability? Because as much as Larry's involved now, I still get a sense of like, where is this trend? Like, is the NBL ever going to be on an AFL level? Is it going to be an amateur? Where does it sit? So, in the context of that decision, like, what do you remember about that?
It was hard. I thought I'd be out of a job.
Same.
But should have it shut down? I still don't think so. And I remember at the time thinking that it shouldn't be. Should have they gone back to amateur? I don't think so, because the quality would have just dropped. I mean, we've already got, at the time we had Siebel. We've already got that. We might as well have just gotten rid of it and gone to that. But the financial, the teams are spending a lot of money, and there has to be a fiscal responsibility by the clubs and the owners and by the agents to not drive clubs into the ground negotiating to get every single cent for their players. And there still has to remain a selling point that Australia is a wonderful place to live. If we can't quite match you financially, Eastern Europe or China, we can certainly provide things that they can't. So that has to remain. It has to be responsible. We have to provide value to the fans. We need affordable ticket prices. We need affordable memberships. Again, there are smarter people than me, but by not shutting it down and by Larry jumping in, certainly we've been able to afford to do things we wouldn't have been able to afford to do. And it's become, history will teach us that it was the right choice or the right decision to make.
Do you think, you talked about a collaboration between kind of agents, players, league. As a coach, did you ever negotiate contracts? And if you did you feel like agents nowadays are operating in good faith, in that good faith to keep?
So, most are, and it's up to the club. I mean, every player is only worth this. Do you want this player? Yes, but at a certain price. Mm. There's got to be a willingness that if you can't get the player for the price you can afford, to find your plan B and then go and build a way to be competitive or successful with a different group of players. And understand that you do have to pay to get top end talent, but you know, Brian Gorgian's one, and it sounds like a bad example because the teams that Gorgian's coached have gone under as well. But you can get good young talent and don't have to pay the earth for it if you can provide development as well. So there are still other ways to recruit. And you know what? I've always believed if a player's coming to your program just for the money and no other reason, you've probably got the wrong player. You've got to provide another reason or multiple reasons that a player wants to join your franchise.
Man, I want to talk about this. No, two names, Nathan Strempel and Boddy Nodge. Boddy Nodge in particular, because he's been around for a long time. Boddy never played in the NBL, but he works in the media and he's got, I think he's got a lot of respect from a lot of players and stuff. And there's a lot of people who listen to this podcast who are wanting to get into sports writing or whatever. What is it about, like, does Boddy have your respect? Why does he have your respect? And what is it about his style of writing or commenting on the game that you know, breeds respect for him?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, I respect the hell out of Boddy. I love the way he writes because it's honest. It's not written to appease anyone. It's not written in a way that the newspaper wants him to write. He doesn't blindly support his team or criticize his team. There's reason for what he writes. And he wrote negative things about me, plenty, and I didn't like reading them, but they were probably right. It's a simple, and you know what, as much as anything, and one of the reasons I respect Boddy from afar before I got to sit down and meet him and get to know him a bit better in my later years is that he was as committed to supporting through his writing the NBL when nobody else was. There would have been every reason for him to stop writing about the Sixers, stop writing about the NBL when the league
jumped
was going
AFL.
For a lull.
Yeah, totally.
But he was providing content, and he was the only one at times that was providing quality content. And the whole of Australia was picking up what he was writing, not just South Australia. And, you know, since I've got to know him and know about his personal relationship with his in-laws to basketball with the Blitzars family and, you know, his ties to so many people, he's a great basketball person, and I've loved not just what he writes, but I love his stories. I love sitting down and having a beer with him and hearing his stories that he doesn't write about, his personal stuff, not his public stuff. And yeah, to go back to your first question, does he have my respect? Absolutely he does, as much as anyone who's written for the NBL.
Tell me, this is my last question for you. Again, for young people, like, because I've done this podcast and I kind of talk about the game and I try and do it in, you know, the Boddy spirit and be honest and sort of give as best I can. But, you know, every now and again, you will be labeled as being like either overly critical or negative. I mean, you've done commentary. What are your advice to people of striking that balance? And whether they're commenting on sports or, gee, meeting people in their workplace, like, how do you go about being honest and giving a good critique and being critical when it's deserved and not just coming across as a salty asshole? Yeah. You know what I mean?
I don't know. I mean, it's... how do I be honest? I mean, I'm not smart enough to remember lies. It's the easiest thing to do is actually commentate on what you see and have my own opinion on what I see and perhaps even sometimes what I do. But I mean, I don't know. I'm not doing commentary anymore, so I probably didn't do a fantastic job. But
are you too honest for commentary? Do you think you're too?
I don't know.
I have a suspicion.
One of the things that I did get asked to do a little bit more was to be exceedingly positive and make sure I was. And I guess I've got too much respect for the viewer and the basketball public to be blindly positive about something they can clearly see isn't a positive or was clearly an error. So, I mean, I think you lose a little bit of credibility through doing that. I don't know. It's... I'd love to do it again. You know, I'd love to call some games. There'll probably be more platforms we can do it on. Mm. You mentioned Nathan Strempel and didn't get around to mentioning him, but he's another one of those great basketball.
He's not a former player, but
he's another great basketball person who I've grown to love over the years. And you know, the reason the podcast was him getting the three of us together with, you know, the three others together. You know, he's got a really fantastic knowledge and insight of men's and women's basketball, both Australia and America. Does a great job emceeing events. I want to do events with him over the years. And you know, he's stuck in Sydney with a personal situation. I'm in Melbourne with my personal situation. So we haven't done anything other than the podcast yet, but another great basketball person that I respect. But same sort of thing, you know, I suppose media outlets and leagues have their people that they want to put on TV. And I'll tell you what, having said all this, I think the way they've done the commentary is great. I think Liam Santamaria is fantastic. Jack Heverin's great. The people who do that, Cam Luke's fantastic. Dwayne Russell. I mean, I could list them all and I'll forget someone. But and then the players they bring on are fantastic. So as long as they provide insight, as long as they're reasonably honest and they provide us something that we don't know, then I can happily sit and watch and have the volume up.
I've actually got a last question on from that. Do you think the players are ready for it? Like you do podcasts about the AFL and the critique of the AFL can be quite scathing at times. Are NBL players, like, are they ready for that level of criticism? You know, because they're not paid an AFL salary, right? Most, you know. So are they ready for
surprise? Some are.
Some are. That's true. But you know, are they ready? Like, if you've been in those locker rooms and have you thought, oh, gee, this new generation's a bit timid? You coach, do you think that, or is that out of bounds?
But I mean, there's a line between being critical or being offensive, and you know, I think everyone in the public eye, you'll have your opinion. You're just going to remember that they're people, and I know that sounds like a really wishy-washy thing to say, right. But you can't just go and criticize someone's decision, for example, without knowing their story. You can evaluate what you see on a basketball floor, but understand that there might be reasons. But I can still commentate on what I see. Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to preparation, and one of the things we spoke about, I mean, I'll use Lamar Patterson as an example because I think it's fair. Like I use Lauren Scherf as an example in the WNBL. The minute they walk onto a basketball court, you could tell they didn't have a great preseason. And that's unfair on the club. It's unfair on them trying to be the best athlete they can be from round one, because I don't think any athlete should come into a professional environment trying to ease their way into a season, because two early losses that you could have avoided if you were a little bit more prepared.
Oh, Chris, I've lost you. I've lost your audio. No. Oh, there you are. You're back. Sorry, I lost you for about 5 seconds there. You were saying you last finished off with two early losses can.
Yeah, two early losses can mean the difference between playoffs and not. My first season coaching the Melbourne Tigers, we missed the playoffs by one free throw.
Yeah,
and it doesn't make it the free throw of the last game. It could have been any free throw in round one or two. They're worth exactly the same. So, you know, there has to be a level. But at the same time, you have to understand reasons. There are probably very good reasons or distractions or personal issues that may have contributed to that. But it doesn't change the fact that that's how you arrived at the start of a professional basketball season. So, you know, there are off-season responsibilities. And there are stories like that everywhere. So you know, whether that's commentary, whether that's criticism, whatever that is, it's observational. And, you know, professional athletes are dependent on TV deals and TV money and TV coverage to generate their income. And it can't just be all sitting around a fireplace singing Kumbaya, I don't think.
Do you think they understand that?
Yeah, most of them do. Most of them are educated. Most of them have the support. I know Peter Gibbs is in charge of, and that's a name not many people know, he's in charge of the player welfare from the Players Association of Men and Women. He does an incredible job. And, you know, there have been certain things that have been said that he's made sure he's stamped out that people, the wider public wouldn't even know. Some things you can't demand someone be cut because that's taking away someone's job, for example.
Right.
There are lines I think you can cross when it comes to livelihoods, personal comments, personal attacks. You've got to be reasonably balanced as well as being honest. So, yes, I do think most people get it, yes, and most athletes do get it.
Chris Anstey, appreciate it.
Really more than welcome. Enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, likewise.